It is Saturday, January 21st, 2011. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. Miles, you want to sing a theme? Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Trock, so please keep in mind the music expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's theme song is inspired by Miles Elam. Miles Elam is with me in the air room. Thank you, Miles, for joining. Very well done. I'm impressed. Miles Elam is a software engineer and political junkie, and of course, a musical expert.
Good morning.
So, we're beginning.
I'm channeling my inner Michael Winslow.
Is that what that was? All right. So, today we're going to be doing calls in the second half, but right off the bat, let's do some news. What's going on in the world of thievery?
Well, with regard to auto theft, for 20 years, the number of cars that have been stolen has been dropping. And it's not a real big surprise. We all know that if you've purchased a car in the last 15 years, you have a car that has a key that has a microchip in it that when you plug it into the ignition, it will unlock it. Or unless the key is within the confines of the car,
it doesn't work.
It
like
doesn't
in your
work,
Prius,
that
right?
type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed like, hey, a win. You can't just, you know, rip out some cables underneath the dash, underneath the console, and then, you know, wire it up and go. However, at the University of California, San Diego, and the University of Washington, they have posted a paper about how more modern cars can be cracked. Mm-hmm. And this is similar to the stories that we've done in the past few years about how the braking system, for example, or the tire pressure system might be hackable. There are so many new electronic devices being integrated with these cars that, you know, a CD player interface or an iPod interface may be crackable, may yeah. give access to the system at large.
I think there was a story about somebody, we covered a story a few months ago about someone cracking in through the Bluetooth interface and being able to engage the brakes whenever they wanted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's also something called the OBD2. This is an interface that's federally mandated in the U.S., which provides direct access to the automobile's key CAN bus, and it provides sufficient access to get to the system. So, if this is not implemented in such a way that you're watching for, you know, buffer overflows or
all
watching
these vulnerabilities we see in software all the time,
right? That software has had to deal with for decades,
right?
You now have to worry about it with your car. So now some particularly intelligent or resourceful thief can walk up to a series of cars to see, like, oh, what's available out there on the menu? And the car that they want, you know, press a few buttons, and the doors unlock and the engine starts running before they even enter the car.
Before they even walk up to see the car.
Right. Now, this is done in a paper. This is a theoretical attack, as far as I'm aware. I don't know if it's showing up in the wild yet, but something to keep in mind, and you never really thought that when I go and buy a new car, I want to see what its vulnerability lists are like. You know, do they have any cert advisories?
Right. Well, it's interesting because, of course, in the software industry, I mean, Microsoft, one of the larger software vendors, they have a once a month, they have a Tuesday release date where they release patches to a whole bunch of vulnerabilities they know about. Mm-hmm. Vulnerabilities can exist
followed
for
by
years.
Exploit Wednesday, but yeah.
Right. Oh, they missed some. Let's release our problems. So to see it in the car industry is a little scarier to some degree. At the same time, at least you physically know where your car is, and this is probably an attack that has to happen relatively close to where your car is. So you go to a mall and you're going to get attacked, but if you park in your garage, you're probably okay. Well, thanks for that. Well, I'll go ahead and do the term of the day. This is kind of related to that. The term of the day, a unknown. You have to answer this question, Miles. You're gonna tell me what the term is after I give some definition from Wikipedia. Okay, it's a device or set of devices designed to permit or deny network transmission based on a set of rules, and it is frequently used to protect networks from unauthorized access while permitting legitimate communications to pass.
Would that be a Firewall?
Ding, 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 ding. Yes, it is a firewall. We use the term firewall sometimes on the show, and I thought it would be good to talk a little bit about what it is. It is this idea. It's just a device that restricts access.
Actually, it may not even be a device. It's a software stack that may be within a hardware device, or it may be on its own in software.
Right. We sometimes talk about having, if you connect your modem, your DSL or normal modem or cable modem directly to your computer, you don't get the added benefit of a router, which acts like a firewall. And one thing to understand about the reason why it's functional so much is that the way computers work, the network stack has an IP address, which we talk a lot about on the show, and then it has ports. And there are any software that's running on the machine can actually start listening and access and communicating via a port. Common ports in there's ports.
Now, when we say
mail.
A port, when we say a port, you can either think of it as like a port of call or a port that you would plug some wire into. It's a convenient abstraction so that people can get their mind around it.
It's really just an extra number.
It's just a number.
It's
a number between 0 and 65,535.
Right.
535.
And we use these ports all the time. It's why you can connect to a system and get your email from that system. You can also connect to that system and get a web page. You can also connect to that system and get time information. These are all different types of protocols that run on the network that use a different identification number called a port to respond to. So the web server is responding on port 80 and port 443 and so on. There's a lot of different ports designed. So a firewall, what we can do with software is you know that, well, these are common ports that we want to have running, so we'll open those up. And anything else, we won't open up. And that is one of the levels of security that we deal with a lot. The cars that are in the wild that are have these problems, the story you just had, they don't have a firewall in the sense that...
Or it's not functioning.
It's not functioning correctly. Potentially.
Yeah. Potentially. Like I said, this is not something that I'm aware of being in the wild. This is a theoretical paper written by a couple of universities. At the same time, it's letting us know that this is a problem.
Yeah, and the thing about a firewall that's really important to understand is that even if you block all the ports that you don't need to use, like you have a functioning firewall, meaning that it stops all traffic that you're not expecting it to have, there's still the ports open that are necessary for communication. There's a lot of them. And if you block those, you wouldn't be able to use the web, for example, anymore. So you need to have those open. And if you're going to have those open, and there's a vulnerability in the web server, for example, it gets taken over. So having the vulnerability inside the service that's listening to a certain port, the firewall can't do anything about that.
Right. And network engineers out there, if you've been working for any length of time, or any significant length of time, I'm sure you've come across this notion of you secure shell into a box, you're changing some firewall rules, and then suddenly you can't communicate with the box anymore because that rule was a little bit off and a little bit too restrictive, and now you're locked out of it and you have to go physically to the box and clear the memory.
Absolutely. It's one that, where the console steps in again. All right, good. You got that term. You're one for one on the quizzes. You weren't here last week, so you missed last week's, but we're doing that every week. I'll quiz the geeks on a term. So let's go on to the next news story from you, Miles. Let's talk about cool science stuff. What's IBM doing in the research labs lately?
Well, IBM, yet again, is the company that has earned the or gathered the most number of patents in 1 year for a single company. And one of those things that they're working on now, because they have such an amazing R&D department, is shrinking down the number of bits that can, the number of atoms you need in order to signify a bit on a hard drive, for example. In other words, taking iron atoms. And right now, hard drives, or researchers have been able to reduce the number of iron atoms down to like about a million. Hard drives are more than that, that are in production. But you always want to see how far you can take it.
This is why the hard drive doesn't quantumly shift its bits necessarily, right? Because you've got enough atoms.
On the contrary, they do. That's why you have error correction.
Okay, go on.
And redundancy. Hard drives are more probabilistic now than they used to be. It's probably a 1 or a 0. So it used to be 1 million, but IBM researchers announced on Thursday that after 5 years of work, they have that number down to 12.
Wow.
12 atoms to signify a single bit.
What atoms are they using? Are they just using...
Iron atoms.
Iron, okay. Yeah. So the same magnetic... Yeah, Chris, you have to have a magnetic domain in there for the head to read it. So that is very sensitive.
Now the
wait, how does the head? Are we talking about a traditional floating head over a hard drive?
No. What they were using was a quantum tunneling microscope to detect where those atoms were.
And so not like for that laptops, is what you're saying?
Not as yet. That's where the engineering challenge comes into play, right. Is that they have to see how can we actually control these without installing a tunneling microscope into every single hard drive assembly.
You know, it's really interesting to think that...
Or rather, even, how to miniaturize a quantum tunneling microscope.
It's interesting that even though we have this I mean, we're using a lot of storage all the time. We have really high densities. It's easy to get a multi-terabyte drive at this point, right? They're made. So therefore, the density of bits on the platter and on the tech in general is pretty small. You'd think it's really small. When you say it's a million bits, that's the general how many... I'm sorry, a million atoms to hold one bit of information. That's kind of amazing that it's actually that many. Atoms are small.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, millions
and volatile, usually.
Yeah. But going down to 12, it seems like then you really would have potential problems with quantum fluctuations affecting the state, wouldn't you? I mean, I would assume. They've got sensitive enough equipment to do it now, though. So.
They are actually, from what I understand, moving the bits
right
slightly.
But wasn't IBM that wrote its initials with atoms with like 12 xenon atoms?
Yes.
Some large atom, I'm not sure what it was, but yeah. Very cool. And being able to read it, of course.
Right, and that was them doing just as a... actually writing them out in how we would look at it.
Right.
Whereas IBM now is working on things as ones and zeros, so writing messages as computers generally read them, or at least binary computers.
So, you know the lore about that connects the Space Odyssey movies with IBM?
HAL 9000. HAL, which even though in the movie they referred to as hard array logic, was actually simply the three letters that preceded I, B, and M.
So that is a rumor. That's not true.
Oh, it's not true.
Clark has denied it. The authors denied it. And so is Stanley Kubrick, who did the films, denied that that's actually the case.
Oh, I stand corrected.
I know. I wanted to look that up because every time I talk about IBM, I mention this like little thing. So on the Wikipedia
I mean, we've
page,
been spreading misinformation about this for 11 years.
But only one piece of information have we ever gotten wrong. So that's
okay. That's a relief.
HAL 9000 is the primary antagonist, for Clark's science fiction Space Odyssey saga. It's heuristically programmable or programmed algorithmic computer. So it's HAL is there. Heuristically. It's also, I didn't think it was that, right?
Yeah, what I thought it was hard array logic. Yeah.
I did too. Yeah. But, you know, Wikipedia couldn't be wrong. So speaking of Wikipedia being wrong or not available, you want to cover
Sorry. One thing to follow up on that IBM thing. There was another little technical issue with making those 12 atoms and 2 bits a reality for everyday computing.
Go on.
Yeah, it was running at 1 degree Kelvin.
Okay. So the atoms aren't bouncing around.
Well, that negative 272 degrees C, negative 458 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay, so if you have extremely low temperatures... the atoms don't move around nearly as much. They don't
right. The byte starts. You are right. The quantum effects are major because the byte starts switching randomly at about once a minute due to thermal energy at about 5 degrees Kelvin.
Yeah. Okay. So Apple's laptops definitely wouldn't work. They're way too hot. So SOPA and PIPA, the two things we've been talking about for a long time, officially dead. Would you say?
No.
I thought it was stopped. I got bad information then.
Well, I guess it was SOPA. SOPA's provision was taken. Oh, wait.
No, I think they're...
No, not in SOPA. Okay. PIPA.
You know, let's not the
Senate
the
version.
Clearly,
yeah, the Senate version, that provision, the DNS blocking provision was taken out.
Right.
But the House version, I believe, is still an
issue. So the other day... multiple sites blocked out their service. I mean, Wikipedia put that service down completely for normal web browsers. You could still access
on the
mobile.
18th, yeah.
And then on the 18th, and Google's image of the day, if you will, was a blacked out space. Mm-hmm. Even Lyle Troxell covered all his pictures with blacked out bars.
Actually, Wikipedia, you could still get access to it.
Yeah,
because like, I was a geek that I was really, you know, I needed to get some information. It's Wikipedia, right?
I think though that it definitely worked. Right, it brought that story to mainstream. There was definitely a lot of discussion about it, and I thought the bills had been stopped because of that, but you don't think so?
Well, no, I mean, it did put a lot more, put a much larger focus on the issues for the general public, because not everyone listens to Geek Speak. Strangely enough, so go tell your friends. This is totally
this
intolerable.
Kind of
so, yeah, when I this actually brings up a very interesting anecdote, which is when I went to Wikipedia, I had forgotten that it was Blackout Day, and I tried accessing it, and of course, Wikipedia had a nice big black background page talking about SOPA, and I think, but I really want to know about that thing, and I wanted to look up. How do I do this? Well, okay, I have Firebug. I'm going in Firefox. Let's go in here. Okay, let's see here. I can find this tag here. Okay, I'll set display none on this. It's overlaying. Okay, set display block to this underlying one. Okay, now I can see the page again. Right. So I'm basically hacking the CSS on the page in order to view the page. And it, as I did that, it reminded me of if the legislation went through and they were blocking DNS, it means that it would block anyone who didn't have knowledge of how DNS works. In other words, people not like you and I,
right.
Lyle. And at the same time, we would become criminals?
I kind of like that. Okay, so what you're saying is that the people that were stopped from being able to access the internet, that would be stopped if PIPA and SOPA actually went forward, are the same people that couldn't access Wikipedia. Anybody that was able to access Wikipedia on the 18th could also probably find anything they need online.
But also the reason why
to be criminals.
But also the reason why SOPA and PIPA were being put up there is because of the so-called hackers and the people sharing copyrighted files in the hackerish way, as modern media tries to portray it. And yet, it didn't stop us from accessing the site. It just made it slightly more inconvenient. But it did stop it for everyone trying to access Wikipedia legitimately.
Yeah.
And that's also what many of us are afraid of with regard to SOPA and PIPA.
Okay, so here's a story about SOPA. I'm quoting VentureBeat. SOPA is essentially dead and we killed it. This is a story from yesterday.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah. Basically, the...
ding dong, the bill is dead.
Basically, yeah. Following the news that the Senate is
or
delaying...
Or the amendment to the bill is dead.
Yeah, the Senate is delaying a vote, the Protect Intellectual Property Act. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Lumar Smith, he's a Republican.
Lumar Smith,
Lumar Smith from Texas, Republican from Texas, issued a statement today admitting that Congress may need to rethink its approach to thwarting piracy. And one of his quotes, I've heard from the critics and I take seriously their concerns regarding proposed legislation to address the problem of online piracy. It is clear that we need to revisit the approach on how to best address the problem of foreign thieves and that steal and sell American inventions and products.
So apparently we got shouted down and now we're going to pretend that we were listening to criticism, which I just have to point out he wasn't.
He wasn't listening to criticism, no. Right. And that's one of the serious concerns that we had as geeks the entire time. The dialogue that was happening in Congress and the Senate about these things was not technical enough. I mean, it seems like a strange thing, but basically what they were trying to do, of course, was a lot of hype and political jargon, but there wasn't the fundamental understanding about how technology works that the geek culture, if you will, understands. And therefore, large corporations like Google and MediaWiki, which runs Wikipedia, shutting down their service and saying, no, you really have to listen to this. This is important. Now, of course, there's some bounce back and flack that says, hey, wait, that's too much power that these companies have, which I think is ridiculous. I mean, they are trying to represent their own needs as well. I find it a little frustrating that I like that it was Wikipedia that got a lot of attention, right?
Actually, I was thinking it was a popular movement, and it had swelled up to include these companies.
Yeah,
it wasn't
it
wasn't those companies leading the charge per se.
Absolutely,
or at least not at the beginning.
So
a very interesting thing. Another anecdote I'm just going to inject right now. So when you have folks like Electronic Arts,
EA,
yes, who make many of the games that many of us play,
And they're a giant copyright creator. I mean, they're copy creator. They're content creator. They create a lot of content. They copyright a lot of content.
Yeah. Absolutely. They, among other game companies, very large game companies, mm-hmm. were all publicly against SOPA.
Right.
However, they were all members of the Business Software Alliance. This was the overarching association of these companies. And the BSA was one of the main proponents of SOPA. So it's this really curious thing of this doublespeak of the individual companies are like, oh, no, no, it's not us. But altogether,
it's
us. Yeah, it's a really odd thing that was showing up, like this weird...
You know, I kind of see that because, of course, I think that a lot of the companies, these software vending companies, a large group of the people that are running them are technical people. They're geeky people. They're part of the culture that I think you and I are part of. And so they see that bill as ridiculous and wrong. With these SOPA and PIPA as being wrong. But at the same time, they're also major corporations. And as major corporations, they have a large legal responsibility to make sure that their content's protected. They have investors.
No, but
and that,
I mean,
that whole arm of the corporation is going to be looking at how to protect their content, and they're going to be playing this game. So it makes a lot of sense that the corporation itself is either kind of split on what they want. I mean, the corporation's not...
But the corporation apparently wasn't split. It's the group of corporations altogether that had the split personality.
Well, I should say that the corporations themselves put money into this group, that this other space, right, that is trying to protect their interest. And in doing that, influenced this bill to be created. So
I see this more as, like, to put it into small judicial terms, say you have a school board. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, 5 members or 7 members of a school board, whichever, you know. And you ask each individual one of them, what do you think about this particular rule that you're about to vote on? Oh, I'm against it. Oh, I'm against it. I'm against it. Like, all across the board, every one of them says that they're against it. And then when the vote comes up, they go, well, we're going
we
to have a secret vote. And the vote comes up, yes, we're voted for it. Wait a second. Okay. You said so you're really all against it.
But see, that to me sounds like, in that situation, the school board's not voting on what they actually feel is correct. Or they're lying to the public when they're actually saying what they believe. It's one of those two things, right? I don't think that's the case in this situation. I think that you actually have an interest in the company itself. The people that run the company have an interest in making a society that's safe, and, you know, they're human beings, right? And then as you merge this level of how do we protect this company and make a corporation or make an organization that's designed around helping the company, it becomes disassociated with freedom of speech. It becomes disassociated with human desires and becomes a different type of thing, that upper level corporation.
Yeah, space. I argue for the latter.
Let us move to your next story. Please tell me about, let's do something fun, like design or something, something cool.
One of the things that has always held back Android, or at least in many people's eyes, held back Android, is the lack of consistency. What people have referred to as fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
In
phone design, there's tons of phones, there's tons of corporations offering service, different things are turned on or off.
Mm-hmm.
Different
features of the phones,
different
screen sizes.
Different. Yeah.
And Apple, on the other hand, has had basically a single screen size for their phones, a single screen size for their tablet, and so you had two different possibilities.
And when they do switch phone resolutions, like when they released the iPhone 4, it was a big marketing push saying this is the new and awesome, and they...
It's quadrupled, and
Well, that's the thing, is I don't think that... I don't inherently think right off the bat the problem with the Android phone market is it's so scattered. I mean, there's definitely a problem there. But I bet you anything, there are some awesome products and some awesome software
there are.
Environment.
It's a very flexible environment. And
what probably some stuff that's better than what Apple's doing.
Oh, certainly.
Argue, right?
Well, first off, they have turn-by-turn directions out of the box. Yeah.
So, what Apple's done that's so clear as different from what Android done is that the design of Apple is so locked down. When you get the
which is already a part of the culture of
Apple's created that culture. Yeah. And in doing that, you know, when they released their software saying you can put stuff on the phone, there were ways to make buttons, and that's how you make a button. The way you do a swipe, the way you do a list, it's all these default standard. What are those? Are those design rules? What are they called?
Yeah, they're design guidelines.
Okay, and Apple doesn't exactly totally force the design guidelines, but they're definitely influential.
On the contrary, if you submit an app that flouts the design guidelines and they don't think it's a good reason,
it's less likely to get up there.
Right. They're more likely to reject it. So it's like, here are the guidelines. Here's what you should do in these scenarios. And only if your app falls out of this scenario should you start branching out and doing this other thing.
Right. I know people that do iPhone apps that are, you know, high-profile iPhone apps, and they've been, like, promoted by Apple on stage and stuff. And the ones they promote on stage are the ones that do a really good job following their rule set and then extend a little bit more, right? But also use all the different features. You produce an amazing, really cool game on the iPhone that doesn't use the doesn't use the gyroscopic sensor. Apple's going to come back and say, you know, you should probably use the gyroscopic sensor. You know, it's like they really try to mold the people that are developing apps.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they definitely have a different aesthetic. I mean, Angry Birds, for example, very popular game on all platforms.
Unfortunately.
I would say that it doesn't have the iPhone version. It's not extremely iPhone-esque. Its menu settings kind of are. But in general, it's very outside of that space. And it's been successful. So they're not totally locking you to design. Android on the other side? Not so much. Totally random?
Android, yeah, one app to another may have a completely different interface, and people will adapt to it fairly quickly, especially if it's an app they're using every day.
Or it's designed well in general.
Right. But the folks behind Android, which would be Google and other other companies, they have launched an Android design site. And the idea behind this is that they want to do something similar to what Apple has done, which is, here's some clear guidelines to have you start off with. This is what you should do as a default if you don't know what else to do.
Right.
And we'll also give you some patterns and some, you know, pieces, some snippets that you can put in, some graphic assets, things like that, so that you can make your app look better and end up still being more consistent.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, I think that's a very nice thing. When I'm doing an app nowadays, any kind of web environment, I try to find a tool set that's already there, because it reduces the amount of design time for me and doesn't confuse. I don't have to make those decisions about should it be, the button should look like this or this. If there's already consistent like dial around what a button looks like, it's easier for me to implement it that way. So I like that they're doing that. So what's this place called? The Android Design Guy?
It's at developer.android.com, but it's cool. Yeah, it's just called Android Design.
All right.
And we'll have a link up.
At some point later today, I'm hoping to get the site up. Yeah, I mean, this version of the show. For the geek bit of the week, I want to mention a podcast that I've been listening to for probably a couple months now, maybe more. It's by Jesse Brown, the podcast called Search Engine. Jesse is a Canadian resident. His bio is great. It's a long rendering of all the cool things he does, but he's a humorist and working in print, radio, television, and film, and technically very savvy. He does these wonderful, I think they're about half an hour long episodes every Tuesday. And it's called Search Engine, which of course is extremely hard to find. So just go to geekspeak.org later today and I'll have his show up. I really like the podcast. The stuff we talk about on GeekSpeak, just imagine a half an hour of one of those subjects with an interview with an expert. It's really quite nice. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. I'm in the air, and with me is Miles Elam. In the other room is Rick Philman, and he's answering the phones. If you'd like to call us with questions or comments about technology, I highly suggest you dial the phone number 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And we will be taking calls. First, I want to send off all Ed from Aptos. On the blackout day, Wikipedia actually posted an open hint to how to circumvent the blackout page. Turn off JavaScript is what they said, basically. The hint was somewhere in the details when you clicked on the SOAP explanation link. That's cool. I didn't know that they did that. I read the SOAP district link document. It was pretty cool. I mean, they definitely told you what's going on. You know, it wasn't like they just...
Right, and they were submitting that JavaScript link for other sites so that they could easily manage it rather than having to retool their site altogether.
Yeah,
to have a consistent message.
Well, thank you, Ed, for calling and mentioning that. In Monterey, Molly, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Yeah, maybe you've already talked about it earlier in the show, which I didn't quite get, but... are you all joining this Swedish church that was formed and recognized by the Swedish government?
What is it?
The file-sharing church, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know anything about this. Miles and Molly, please do tell. Do you want to give us your...
If Miles could talk about it, I'm sure he'd know a lot more about it.
I don't know much more than I think you do, that there's a recognized religion in Sweden based upon file-sharing, saying that file-sharing is part of their doctrine.
Right.
And therefore protected.
I'd have to read the doctrine. I don't just prescribe to doctrines.
Anyway,
much,
it was the last week, and I just thought...
That's awesome.
I decided to mention it.
Thank you for that story. That was wonderful.
Yeah, very cool. Thanks, Molly. Molly in Monterey, if you'd like to join us with questions, comments about technology, please do so. Lots of times, the stuff that we talk about on air, we know a bit about, but somebody else listening knows a lot more about. So if you know something else about what we're talking about, please do call. If you have questions about technology, how your computer works, what you think about a recent legislation, whatever it is, we'd love to hear your thoughts.
Right. And if you have any corrections for us, get stuff. We're never wrong.
Yeah, right. 1-800-655-5877. Again, the number is 1-800-655-5877. And Rick is standing by. We have time for another a news story. You've got some information about... disease in India.
Yes, two quick little bits. One, I'll start with the good news. The good news is, for 2011, India announced that there were no new cases of polio.
For the entire year?
Yes.
Awesome.
So they hit that milestone
to get rid of polio in general. Completely.
Right. And the U.S. had the same push in the...
But I mean planetary push, you know, that we're trying to get rid of this disease completely. So India doesn't have polio right now at all. That's pretty amazing.
Well, this year it doesn't. There are still children who are suffering from it, but and have suffered the effects.
Sure.
But yes, there were no new cases.
That's pretty cool.
That whole year, which is a amazing milestone for a country that has so many people and at the same time has many areas in such dire straits in terms of poverty and lack of access to clean facilities. Now, the bad news. Mm. Also in India, totally drug-resistant TB has emerged.
Tuberculosis.
Yes.
Oh, no.
And we're not talking about drug-resistant TB. That's where it, you know...
What's really hard to get rid of, but you can get rid of eventually with antibiotics.
Or the mostly drug-resistant TB, which is the type that most of them don't work, but you can find one that will work, one particular anti-TB drug that will work. This, all our forms of drugs that we know how to treat TB with don't work.
Oh, man.
And it is a deadly strain of TB.
Well, that's why didn't you give the bad news first or offer bad news or good news? Okay, thanks. Sad. You know, we should have had Don on and talk more about that. I mean, the resistance of organisms to our fighting them is a really serious concern.
And I should mention also that one of the reasons why polio was knocked down was because India has instituted an aggressive form of trying to get vaccinations out there, because this is what vaccinations are for.
Right, exactly.
Getting rid of those pieces. And with regard to TB, the reason these drug-resistant forms show up is because they're not treating correctly. You end up with someone getting TB, you give them some medicine, and they head off and don't come back, in which case you can't give the full course.
Right.
And what you need to do is you have some medicine, you have to go through the full course and wipe it out of your system, or else you get these drug-resistant viruses.
Right. And we're all familiar with this problem lately. If you do get something where you want to get your bronchial infection, some kind of infection, you get antibiotics, your doctor's very clear. Don't take them until you feel better. Take it until the medication is done. Because even if you have a slight bit of this organism still in you after 4 days, you don't feel any ill results from it. You haven't killed it completely.
And you may feel better. You may end up getting better.
Will. You probably will
feel better. But you'll be contagious with this horrible...
And more importantly, the only part of that organism that's still left is the one that did pretty well against the drug. So you're breeding, a more drug-resistant organism.
Right.
So make sure if you're taking antibiotics to go through the entire assignment. You know, if it's a 10-day thing, do it for 10 days. Or you're producing bad organisms in your body.
Right. And if possible.
Which you probably won't get hurt from, because by the time that happens, your immune system's okay with that organism. It can fight that organism. But you still might be contagious enough, hopefully.
Yeah. That's the second stage of trying to handle it. The first stage is to get that vaccination for pertussis, for tuberculosis, so that you don't get the disease in the first place, nor do your neighbors.
Another call from Monterey. You can call even if you're not calling from Monterey. The phone number is 800-655-5877. Mark, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi.
My mouse doesn't move to the left anymore.
It always moves to the right?
It will only move up and down and to the right. Do I need to get a new one? I've taken the ball out and cleaned the...
Oh, it's got a ball?
Beg your pardon?
It's got a ball?
Yes.
This is interesting. Moving only one direction on a mouse.
That means there's some... there's probably some gunk on the wheel, assembly.
I've tried to clean that off. I've taken it out and wiped it with alcohol in the contact. So the inner rolling thing, I've tried to... clean the gunk off of it. Yeah,
so there's
gunk on the bottom, I didn't see any gunk that I cleaned off. But
right. For a rolling ball, what's happening inside the mouse, the ball actually touches two different rolling shafts, if you will. And those shafts are either, in the last 10 years, they have all been optical. They've got a little disc on them that interrupts a light for each one of these things.
Right.
And as it pulses, as that light pulses, you get to know that it's moving. But if you just had it pulse directly, the mouse wouldn't know which direction it's moving. So potentially it has two sensors, and that would make sense to me. it's kind of complicated, the mechanical organism of that. The other thing is that the older mice weren't optical. There was actually like a little motor in there. But that's really, I would assume, very rare.
Yeah, but let's cut to the chase here. How much do you really love that mouse? Because frankly, an optical mouse.
I just don't want to buy a new one if I can fix it.
Yeah, I think you need to buy a new mouse.
Okay.
And at the same time, the only reason I say that is that the of it moving only one direction and not moving the direction, there's no reason for the operating system to do that. The only thing I can think of is that
it's a hardware failure.
It's probably a hardware failure. I mean, almost certainly a hardware failure. And so therefore, yeah, a new mouse. Now, if you've got a Windows machine, it's a relatively old one, it might be a PS2 mouse.
It might be a what?
It might be there's two different types of mouse connections, PS2 or USB. Two different technologies.
It's either a circular or it's a flat rectangle.
Right, right. So you want to definitely turn off your computer and pull that mouse. If it's got a purple head to it and it's round, that's called a PS2. And you don't necessarily have to get that. You can get a USB type.
Oh, okay.
And therefore, it might be easier for you to find a USB mouse.
Okay, so USB might just be easier to find, not necessarily better. But
now, there are still mice that are sold that have
absolutely
both the USB and the PS2.
Yeah, most of them actually come with that kind of dongle that allows you to do either. But this is very important. If you're used to a ball-type mouse, you have a certain feeling of a pretty heavy mouse and a lot of physical tactile response of the mouse. And for a long time, I was in that space where I liked a ball mouse. I finally moved to an optical mouse, and I got used to it after a period of time, but it is a little bit different experience. And it's easier for you to also find an optical mouse now because there's no moving parts.
Only if you get a cheap one, though. Like, as you get more expensive, they get the heavier weight and they'll feel the same. But, yeah.
But go try them out. Go to one of those stores and try them out and have a good time. And also, one thing, since we're talking about mice, everyone should know this about... Oh, sorry. On computers, it's mouses, not mice. Mouses for computers. If you're doing stuff a lot with the mouse, you actually are hurting your hands more than if you're doing it with your keyboard. So if you go up to the edit menu and the copy and then the edit menu and the paste over and over again, get used to using your key commands. It's actually better for your hands.
There's what commands?
There's key commands to do copy and paste rather than using the mouse to do it.
You have a Windows machine?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it'd be stuff like Control S to save, Control O to open.
Control C to copy, Control V to paste. Now these things, all of these commands are available with your left hand, or a lot of them are available with your left hand. So your mouse is hands on your right hand, you select your text, and then your left hand, you can do a copy.
And where do you find that instruction?
Well, the instructions for those key commands, sometimes they're actually in the operating system under the file menu. So if you go up to File, Copy, sometimes you'll see to the right of that at the end of that line of text that says Copy, you'll see the commands to do it. If not, look for Windows shortcut keys, I guess is what they're called.
Okay.
And I recommend everybody
try this. If I press that, I might get the instructions as an option.
I would doubt it. This is one of those things where the operating system, it doesn't, you know, so the operating system in general is going to work for somebody that has very basic skills, and it's designed that way so that anybody can use it without a lot of pre-knowledge. And then if you pick up skills that are more advanced, they might not even talk about those skills necessarily. But I don't know. I'm not in front of a Windows machine to check. But you're looking for shortcut keys. Good luck or command.
As an aside, but really you need a new mouse.
So there's a mouse. Yeah, don't try to go through the world without a mouse.
Mouse sounds a lot faster.
Yeah, definitely. Well, copy and paste without the mouse using a key command is much faster.
No, really?
Oh, yeah. Any programmer is going to know a lot of key commands because as you're, and we work with text all the time, you know, programmers are just text editors, basically, smart, you know, skilled text editors. So we are copying and pasting all the time. You move stuff around, you do a find. All of these things are keystrokes. If you see me or Miles program, you'll notice that we rarely touch the mouse, actually.
Well, I touch the mouse quite a bit.
Why?
But I like the menus in general, but yes, for things like save, open, things like that, that's usually
keyboard.
There's
even key commands to go to the end of the line, go to the next word, select word by word to the left or right.
Right.
These are all key commands that we use all the time. So,
but there's no way to move the cursor, is there, without the mouse?
There is, but I wouldn't do it. No, you need the mouse also on a Windows machine.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay.
And on Macintosh, too. There are ways of doing it without, but on a Windows machine, actually, in XP, for example, you could function completely without a mouse. You would go insane, but you could do it.
No, beginning in the line, end of the line, it's on a Windows machine, is home and end.
Yeah, well, no, to get to the file menu, you could get to the file menu with, Alt something? Just Alt. I think just Alt.
Yeah.
If you push Alt on your keyboard, you should see a file menu selected, and then you can use your cursors to move around in the file menu.
Yeah, up and down.
But don't
arrows.
Do that. It'll drive you crazy.
Okay, so I have options.
Mark, thank you so much for the call. Go ahead and pick up a mouse. You know, if you know some friends that have computers, it's very possible somebody has an extra mouse laying around. I know I've got extras.
Okay. Okay.
They just kind of build up.
In the garage then, come
yeah.
think of it.
Yeah, good luck.
Okay, thanks.
You can call us with questions and comments about technology. Listen to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. Answering the phones is Rick Filman. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Let me do that again slow enough for people to hear it. 1-800-655-5877.
Something that is curious is that your choice of mouse ends up being a very personal decision.
Yeah.
The keyboard somewhat, but I find people have a much bigger affection for mice. Because the keyboard...
Well, they're so cute.
Well, the keyboard you have, you know... Do the keys have a good action, whatever? And there's a nice wide range that you're okay with. Mm-hmm. In general, they're the same format. They're similar spacing. You can deal. Mice, however, vary quite a bit. Some of them are form-fitting. Some of them are up on the side. Some of them have the wheel on top. Some of them, you know, have a little ball on top. There's the Mighty Mouse from, or the Magic Mouse, rather.
I can't stand that mouse.
Yeah.
You like it?
Well, there's the Mighty Mouse, then there's the Magic Mouse.
The Mighty Mouse is the one with the little
with the
rolly ball.
Ball yeah,
top.
That one's horrible.
I don't
horrible.
Like that one at all. But the Magic Mouse is a pretty good mouse.
Yeah, that one is, there's just like touch field at the top of it. So it ends up being...
I have to say that if I'm using a mouse and working on a problem that's frustrating me, if the mouse is something that doesn't feel good in my hand, I definitely feel it by my shoulders tightening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the hockey puck mouse. That was horrible. Yeah.
The colored iMac mouse.
Oh, man.
Oh, man, those things are cool.
But at the same time, when people are getting mice, it's just because this has been brought up, buying the cheapest mouse you can is very seductive. And I've done so before because I'm like, I just need a mouse. I just need a mouse right now. And they're horrible. Like
it's like wearing getting the cheapest shoes and not trying them on. I mean, you got to really like what the experience. You use it a lot.
Right. If you just need one as a standby, you can get by. Like I bought the...
You can buy mice that are like $120. I mean, they exist.
Oh, yeah.
And even more.
And you can also buy the mouse as $2.
Yeah. And the $2 mouse ain't so good. And the $120 is insane. So there's one in there in the $30
right. The $120 one has like 7 buttons.
And weights in it that you can remove and add back in to get the right weight to it.
It may even have a gyroscope in it for you to do some 3D motion.
Yeah. The other thing is if you're using an optical mouse on a table surface... or like a piece of paper and you're always having trouble with it detecting it, go ahead and get yourself something that will actually work as a pad that functions well. You know, if you have a glass tabletop and you're always using a piece of paper, I find that really frustrating. Actually get the right spot for a mouse to function.
Yes, that's right. We did talk about mice just for 5 minutes.
Yeah. So Apple released some new stuff for education in general this week. Did you follow that story, Miles?
No, I did not.
Oh my gosh. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about it. So first off...
Man, I got a kid.
No, you got an infant. That's totally different. So here's the story. Apple released this week a little press release. It was about education in general, and it was a lot of education stories. One of the things they did is they're releasing very cool textbooks on the iBook store, or iBook textbooks. And these things, they released a whole bunch of science high school books. They're $15 a piece, something like that. And they are full multimedia encounters, if you will. I wish I had the iPad that's in that bag in there. Maybe I'll grab it while we're talking next. After the show, I'll show you to Miles. Basically, it's, you know, you take your chem book or take your biology book and you're looking through and say, oh, let's look at a cell. And instead of the cell has a picture, maybe it would be a chapter and a half in a traditional book because you'd have to know all the different elements about the cell. In this, it is 4 or 5 interactive slides where you can select the different elements inside the cell picture and it gives a description of what it is. You can see the density based on different diseases. There's a really amazing interactivity to this.
So is this college level or is this like middle school level?
What I'm talking about is high school.
Okay.
But they are releasing, also, they released a free app called the iBooks Author, and anyone can make an iBook that is like this. It's kind of, imagine it as a PowerPoint type of thing with video embedded. It's all gesture-based, so it's designed for the iPad only. And you right now could download this app on your Macintosh for free. It's called iBooks Author. Make any book you want. Put in video, put in pictures, text, audio, and interactive stuff. And then publish it to their store, and they'll get a cut off of it. And you can also save it as PDF and distribute it. So pretty cool.
Right. The reason why I asked what level it was because $15 seems like a really great deal because anyone who has taken the intro bio sequence knows that those books are $150, $200.
Okay, let me tout some more features that they released, and then we'll talk about the bad side because there's a very big bad side.
Okay.
It's creepy. So the next thing is, you know, iTunes U, it's been this section in iTunes, which is university-based, and you could get podcasts and lectures, and it's basically structured around certain universities have these programs where they open their classes up for free. They put them on iTunes U, and you can then take the class.
It's a resource just like Khan Academy that are just
absolutely
going
and
to...
And they're amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, Stanford's got a whole bunch.
Highly recommend
Harvard's
them.
Got some.
MIT's got one.
MIT's got some. And the basic idea is that, yes, you can use it for the instructor can use it directly in the class. They record all the lectures and everything. And then the next year, potentially, the students can take it or anybody can take it or retake it without having to take the course itself. So you can go learn how to program an iPhone from Stanford, and it's an amazing class, and all the resources are there. Of course, you can't actually get feedback from your homework, if you will, but you can get everything. Now, they're enhancing that to allow linking directly to chapters in their books. So now if you do a class and you use one of the textbooks that's through iBookstore, you can have an instructor say, the instructor can say, okay, here's the lesson plan. You know, week two, read this chapter, and you click on it, and it opens your book to the right chapter. Pretty cool. They also have some stuff about when the faculty will be available for open office kind of space, right? When they'll be in their office. So pretty neat, right? Good education support. Mm-hmm. The books can be given away for free as well. I don't know if they're going to host them on the iBookstore for free. Here's the downside. The end user license agreement from Apple hasn't gotten a lot of play, but it's nasty. And one of the things it says is if you use...
Are Apple end user license agreements never, ever not
they're
nasty?
They're never not. But here's the thing. In a screen when you're installing the software, when you want to do an export of your book that you've made, it's like a PDF or something, this is what it says. Important note, if you charge a fee for any book or other work you generate using this software, you may only sell or distribute such work through Apple. And such distribution will be subject to a separate agreement with Apple. You want to make a book with their software? You don't own the book. Creepy, huh? Now, I kind of get it, right? The software is free, and therefore, how's Apple going to make money on it? Well, they're going to make money because people are going to be making content that they'll then sell through their store. But if you make the content, save it as a PDF, and then sell it directly, Apple's not making any money at all. So they're saying if you make anything with this, you can't make any money off it unless you go through us.
Hmm.
So don't use this application. Is my general feeling. The other thing is, why doesn't Apple just release, say, hey, by the way, you can buy this application. We remove that restriction. This application costs $80. You know, just do that. So I'm tempted to make a book at the same time. I don't, and I'm not probably going to sell it. I'm probably going to give it away because I'm just that kind of person. I don't make money. I'm not a publisher. I'm not a writer, definitely. But it feels creepy, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
And that's just a warning in the EULA.
And,
really
and another warning, if you buy a book from Lyle, make don't sure it's not a spelling book.
No, that's why there's video and audio. I don't have to spell. Awesome. Book in the loosest defined term possible. Well, we have not taken any other calls, and I think you're out of news stories.
This nope, I got one
ever.
More.
Oh, darn it. Go ahead.
Bluetooth is getting long in the tooth.
You know it is. Bluetooth is the personal connectivity device where you can use your hands-free headsets and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Connect your phone to your car.
It's only useful for very low bandwidth, or relatively low bandwidth. In other words, being able to send audio, maybe stereo, but over a short distance. At the best case scenario, it's got about a 10-meter range.
Right.
And
you'll kind of know this because you'll see how it gets interacted. Like my iPhone has Bluetooth. My laptop has Bluetooth. When they sync, they use Wi-Fi, right? Because there's just not enough bandwidth there to transfer all the data that needs to transfer. So Bluetooth's not capable of those types of things.
Right. Well, there is a new spec on the horizon. It is by a group called the Y-Gig Alliance. And
is it gigabit wireless?
It is 2 gigabit per second wireless.
Wow, that's really fast.
Yes. It's also low power. It's the same constraints that Bluetooth was trying to go
what's,
for. Trying
what's
to
its range?
And its range is exactly the same as what Bluetooth was, which is 10 meters. In other words, this is not going to replace the Wi-Fi that you have in your house.
Right. Because it probably doesn't go through walls or anything, right?
It does not go through walls very well at all, actually at all, because it's using the 60 gigahertz spectrum.
Oh, interesting.
Very short wavelength.
Right.
And at the same time, it means that you're able to have the bandwidth to be able to not have a video cable.
Yeah.
The bandwidth
that kind of
to
bandwidth.
Yeah. Oh. That your hard drive doesn't have to have a connector to your system. You just have the hard drive sitting on the desk and it just works.
As long as you power it up.
So, as long as it's powered up.
So
right.
With this, if you had systems involved, like your television was like this and your phone was like this, you could send videos right to your phone, right to your television streaming and play it basically.
Yeah.
Very
in,
cool.
In theory, some people have done that already, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, not through Bluetooth, though.
With the,
Bluetooth,
yeah, almost. UPnP, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's very cool. I like. This is a spec that's in design, right? It's not on the market yet, by any means.
Yeah, they're still working on it. You'll probably see devices from it in the next couple of years. So 2013, maybe sometime late next year.
All the news and information we talk about on GeekSpeak is available at geekspeak.org. Please feel free to visit us.
Eventually.
Eventually. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org, and we have a minute and 20 seconds left before the car guys come on. Miles, got something else to say?
Ooh, sure. One last little tidbit, going out of our comfort zone, but it's just such a cool story, I have to cover it. Even if I only do it in a haphazard, you know, ham-fisted way.
Go on.
Some researchers have found a form of life that is half plant, half animal, but not really a clear line between the two. And
go on. This is not uncommon, right, for animal-type life to have chloroform, chloroform? For example.
Chlorophyll. Yeah. But no, this is a bit more. It's it has hair-like cilia to move around in water to get other organisms rather than synthesizing nutrients themselves. And they engulf other microorganisms like algae. But then together they have this curated hybrid style.
They connect together to become a large organization that's a plant?
Yes.
Very cool. What's it called?
Oh, M. Chameleon.
M. Chameleon. You can learn more about it at geekspeak.org, and I'll try to get the show up today, I promise.